Hi, this is Carolyn Sloan from the Maine Humanities Council, and I'd like to welcome you to another in our series of podcasts exploring the power and pleasure of ideas.
Sculptures and teaching, or so that I can find a way to make a living. And I sell my parts and all of my paintings around town, and I had an agent who would market the cards and the shows for my work. One day in 2004, in October, I was having my second cup of coffee, and the phone rang to say, "Hello, Rebecca Ray, this is Tilbury House Publishing." And I thought it was a publishing clearinghouse. So I almost hung up. And she said, "We know your work. Would you like to illustrate a children's book?" And I just wanted to scream, but then I said, "Oh dear, what if I can't visualize it?" And she said, "We have the story, let me read it to you on the phone." And when she read the story, it was "Thanks to the Animals," written by a Passamaquoddy native whose mother used to tell him the story when he was a little boy. And I heard the first paragraph, and it was about wildlife coming to the rescue of this little boy, and he'd fallen off the bobsled during their family's migration. And I couldn't believe it. I had tears in my eyes by the end of the conversation. It was every animal that I painted and animals that I've been curious about, that I did want to research and do paintings of. And that was just imagine telling the grandson the story. The words will come from elsewhere. It's true. I just had the drawings and then the storyboard. And then there it is. So it's wonderful to have it. And again, I had to watch out for the daughter. And then one of the texts will be, I have a third book I just signed the contract for. So excited about this experience that I am aware, and those pictures I think will be even more. That's sort of a brief thing. If you have questions, I'll answer them. If you have questions, I'll answer them. No one jabbers off my phone.
Well, I am so glad that there are people who are illustrators because. Things just don't come out of me as pictures. I've always liked to write, and that's what I like to do. I didn't turn out to be a ballerina, and I didn't turn out to be a sculptor, and whatever, but I have always liked to write. I think when my two sons were little, and I reread all the children's stories to them that I loved, and I kind of felt that time was passing, and if I wanted to try writing, I better get busy. So I wrote a lengthy novel for kids, and I wrote it three times, and it never ended. And when I put it in the drawer, I wanted to do something completely opposite. Something very short, something nonfiction, just something I could kind of start and get to and finish. So I knew there were lots of topics of nonfiction in the library that have been covered. I don't know whether you know it, but there are books on forks and books on fireworks and bread, you know, you name it. So I was getting into bed one night. Actually, you know, when you're a writer, you have little antennae that are up, and you're just always looking for ideas. So anyway, I was getting into bed one night, and I just suddenly thought, beds. I thought this was the greatest idea that anybody had ever thought of, and I bothered my family with news and information about beds for the next 2 years, I think, because I just thought it was so great. And I had a vision of a long children's book. You know, these are all 32 pages, but I was thinking 48, 64 pages, you know. This was such a great idea. Send it off to sample chapters, the whole thing. I mean, sent stacks of bed information off to about 12 editors, got 12 rejection slips. One editor suggested that it would make, she thought, a much better idea for young kids who were maybe still taking naps, moving into their first big beds. You know, beds are a big deal. And I thought she was crazy, and I was angry, and I said, I will never do this. And 6 months later, I thought, oh, maybe I'll just take a look at this manuscript again and see if I can cut anything out. This was a really good lesson for me. When I looked at this manuscript, I cut everything in half and threw out so much information because I also realized the illustrator was going to tell half of the story. And I didn't have to put in every single detail, which would be really boring. So I sent off a much shorter manuscript to Holiday House in New York. And 2 weeks later, the editor called. I mean, 2 weeks is really short, you know. Usually it's 3-4 months or something, if ever you hear from her. So 2 weeks later, she called, and I almost hung up on her because I thought it was, you know, I just wasn't expecting it, and I thought it was like a crank call or something. So Bedtime was published, and it's a history of beds. And I love doing the research. I research about all over the world, different periods. It's just lots of fun. It got into facts about sleeping, and there are facts about sleep in the back. It was just, it's like a treasure hunt. You just never know where you're going to go and what you're going to find. And I, at some point, I went to New York and had lunch with my editor, one of those, you know, just you can barely eat, you're so excited. And she took me to a Japanese restaurant. I thought this was a test. You know, can I use chopsticks? Anyway, I was ordering some pork. Even though I wasn't going to eat a whole lot. I mean, I tried to count, too, you know. The best thing about this lunch was at some point she sat there and looked at me and said, "So, Ruth, what do you want to do next?" It's like, you know, like the greatest question I'd ever been asked. And CareDo was next. So I was teaching nursery school at this point and had my own two children. But nursery school, you know, kids coming in with new barrettes and new braids and even the boys with their new buzz cuts for the summer and their new bowl haircuts. And hair was a way that even as kids, you know, you can show who you are or who you want to be. And it's a way to express ourselves. So hair was really fun. Again, I did research about all over the world, lots of different periods. That made a great time doing the hair book. And then my editor said, "What do you want to do next?" And I really wanted to do a history of candy. Again, being at nursery school, candy is a big deal. You know, Valentine's and birthday cakes with M&Ms on them. And it's something that you can afford as a child. It's like one of the first things you can buy with some pennies and you can share. And so candy was just a real treat. And this was a new illustrator. This is John O'Brien. Here's Goldilocks and the three gummy bears. He's really clever. I mean, nonfiction is fairly dry. It's just information. It's a lot of facts. And he does these great pictures. They're very funny. It's something for adults, too. I mean, you can look, and the Egyptians have, they were busy eating honey candies. But the Egyptian man has a beehive instead of a wig. And the pyramids in the back are Hershey's Kisses. I mean, you know, kids may see it, but, I mean, their parents, when they're reading the book, are going to have a great time, too. And candy, you know, you get into sugar, you get into maple sugar, preserving fruit. People thought candy was a medicine at first when it was coming back in the 13th, 14th century but with the Crusaders. Chocolate, gum, then I put recipes in the back, and then I did a timeline. My editor was saying that librarians and teachers really like as much information as possible, so we did a timeline that she liked and gave that 3 pages. So a lot of history of candy. And then underwear. Moving right along, you know, I mean, you know, underwear was actually a topic that my publisher came up with the idea, and they said, "Ruth, you think you'd just be perfect for underwear." So I, and again, you never know what you're going to find. And with underwear, you get into cotton, cotton and slave trade, you get into whaling and whalebone with all the bones in the corsets and the petticoats, steel, nylon, linen, I mean, it's rubber, spandex, commodities. This is coming out in September. Oh, and the other thing that I didn't know about, at the end I have a section in here about recycling clothes. I had written to a couple of women who I found from friends of friends of friends in Africa to find out what was going on in Africa. And they don't wear much underwear in Africa because of the climate. But I did find out there's a whole story about when we get rid of our clothes, when we turn them into Goodwill, some of them turn into doll stuffing and rug pads and things like that, but other clothes are shipped in bales to third world countries way of people making money, and our clothes just go on and on and on and on. And you'll see in magazine pictures, you know, people with Chicago Cubs T-shirts or whatever, and it's because our clothes have a whole other story. I think in all of my books, one thing I'm really trying to do is to help children look at ordinary, everyday things like underwear and to notice them, to be aware of things around them, even everyday things, because it's amazing what has a story to it. So this is history, and it's fun, and it's light, but I am trying to get kids to kind of wake up and just be aware of something that they don't even notice. It's just every day, but it's actually kind of fascinating. I'm working on something for adults.
Okay, I'm going to ask again. Often, kids ask me, they say, how did you decide you want to be a writer? Or when did you decide you want to be a writer? And I always try to tell the truth to kids. Adults, you guys are on the road, but kids are true. The story I tell is, and it's a true story, is when I was in ninth grade, I was this hotshot English student, and the teacher used to like us, at the end of a major reading assignment, to write what came next. So we won book 25 of the Odyssey. Right? And then we read Idols of the King. These are ancient days. We read Idols of the King. And she said, what about what happens next? And I, of course, being a hotshot English student, didn't do it early. In fact, the morning it was due, I remember vividly sitting at my father's desk, which my father paid his bills. Like a leather insert. And I started writing. And I really liked what I was writing. It's not writing, 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 writing. And it was blank verse. And I handed it in to my teacher. Actually, he handed it back. And before that, I loved reading. I'm a reader, not a writer. So she handed it back, and she gave me an A. And said she thought it was going to be really good. Went home, my sister was jealous, my parents were friends. And then the school newspaper, the high school newspaper, the final edition, the June edition, asked if they could publish this poem I'd written, Son of Idols of the King Virgin. So, yeah, sure, this is great, this is even, my classmates were jealous. They published it. My parents were prouder, my grandfather would feel better. Guys I was interested in. They had interesting things to say. So a very positive experience. And I thought, this is great. You're a writer. Everybody says nice things to you. They envy you. They want to know you. They say, what could be better? I'll be a writer when you grow up. Right? I said, that's it. Direction in life, I found it. Being stubborn, I stuck with it. And failed. Being published counts as being a writer, which it does. Pretty much failed for about 25 years. In the interim, I discovered teaching. Wonderful profession. And every now and then, you know, I was sort of writing. In your copious spare time as a teacher, I'm going to be I used to take summer vacations. I was busy recovering from the But, you know, you're writing, and you're always, and every now and then I'd have something, not very often, and I'd send it out, and I figured if one person likes it, if it's good enough, everybody will know it's good enough. And if nobody thinks, you know, if somebody doesn't think it's good enough, then it's not good enough. So you send it out, and you wait 3 months. And it comes back, and you've been rejected, right? And you say, okay, this is not good enough, try something else. And this went on for years and years and years. Until one day, I was a teacher and a mother, happy mother. And I did my shopping on Fridays to save money and to keep control of my time. So my mother's going to go shopping. But I parked my car in the parking lot. And next to me, there's a station wagon with kids in it. They didn't swear at me. They didn't throw anything at me. They didn't hit one another. I mean, there's something stunning about it. And I never leave my children in the car. Never. I know everybody wants to steal my children. So I go into the mother's through the electric door. And for some reason, as I walk through the electric door, I thought to myself, what would happen if nobody came back to those kids? And I got as far as the tomatoes probably. going, I really want to be a writer as well. I don't want to give anything up. I write business as a wisdom idea. And by the time I get to the meat department, I had realized a major problem with whatever I was thinking of, which was, why would anybody leave their kids in the car and not come back? The credibility thing. I went home and I started writing. At all, and suddenly the book became twice as long as it started out to get this character in there. Okay, so there's a certain accidental problem. And then I had finished it, and this is good for computers. So I typed up the first half, some 400 pages. I had written all of them, but not the first half. And I figured, I am tired of sending things out, waiting 3 months, having to get rejected. So I sent it to 5 different places, the first 3 chapters. I said, this is what you're looking at. Are you interested in seeing the rest of it? And 4 of them wrote back. One publisher had moved to let no forwarding address, which is sort of curious, right? The other 3 were various degrees of lack of interest. Somebody said, you don't need help, or no plot, and the 5th person said, we'd like to see the rest of it. And I was then looking at 4 typing pages. I didn't have a 5 copies typed up, which is a problem in itself. But eventually they did, in fact, buy it and publish it. And it's my entry level, my entry in the first book, which was, a very nice moment. But what I realized, 2 things from that, which is really very interesting about publishing. One is that just because one person doesn't like it, doesn't mean, it's like selling a house. What you've got to find is the person who likes the house and can afford the price and wants to buy it. Just because somebody doesn't like your kitchen arrangement doesn't mean your house will never sell. Which for me came as a surprise. And the other thing is, as I learned later, there's the publishing house which needs to buy it. What I had was a woman who read the first 3 chapters and took it in and sold it to her boss. I mean, it was really chance, because as they told me when they were doing the revisions, they said, it was at that time the most expensive children's book that had been published, and I paid it down to 100 manuscript pages to get it, to make it short. This woman saw something in what I was doing that she was willing to do the sales of her boss about. If she had had, I don't know, a bad breakfast, if she'd been out with food poisoning, I would have been at the home typing, teaching very happily, and my life would not have developed as it developed. And as far as I'm concerned, that's pretty much my career, right? You have to be extremely stubborn, right, and fail for a number of years, and then, if you're lucky, you might be lucky. But the important thing, as far as I'm concerned, is the writing plan. When you're sitting there and you're actually writing it, or drawing it, we'll look at it. That is the thing that really is where the satisfaction and the happiness lies. The heady stuff looks very heady, but the satisfaction is in the work. And that is my career. And the conversational ball passes to you. They sold it eventually, I think, $13 or $14 a copy. But if it had had my original length, I was protesting the cops, you see. I think I'd failed for 25 years. They could pay me back. It would have been like $24, which was, in 1981, not the right charge for a children's book. At that point, I didn't quarrel with them at all. Artistically, I was quarreling with them, but financially, I figured they were going to, you know, they were right.
So if you are a children's daughter, you don't have to become a children's daughter. Do you require some school credit because of the 45 years of waiting in college?
You know, I got to be a school teacher. It's either passive or zen or something, but it seems to me that it's really, you should do what you want to do. And if what you want to do is something that doesn't earn you a living, then you find a way, if you can, of earning a living that satisfies you. I would say, hey, you want it? Sure, try it. Can I read it? And she might say no. I'd love it, but I would. I'd love it if she tried it. She's a good writer. Start out writing, you put down every detail. You know, you describe something and you describe every little piece of it. And the one example I'll give you, in the bed book, in Egyptian beds, because I thought this was so interesting, I had a sentence that said something about Egyptians painted their beds. They painted their beds white, black, gold, red, blue, yellow, and green. And I wanted to get every single color in there because that's what I had learned through all my research. And when I was cutting stuff out, I realized I only really needed to say they painted their beds. And then the illustrator is going to take it away.
How does the illustrator, how does the illustrator know? I mean, you have this list of colors, which are specific. Do you tell the illustrator that they have to be?
I never talk to the illustrator. I never. The editor is the one, in my experience, who has the vision of the finished book. And I found out I'm just one piece. And after I turn in my little typed manuscript, they don't need to hear from me again.
That I noticed were by the same illustrator. But you have some other illustrators in there too? Or are they all the same?
The first two books were Kat Bowman Smith, and the second two were John O'Brien. The only thing I do is when I'm doing a research, and if I find something pretty obscure that the illustrator may never run across, I send copies of the pictures, or it's usually a copy of a picture. I send all that to my editor, and then she sends it on to the illustrator. So that's, and the illustrator does research too. In the bed book, there's a carriage in there. It's supposed to be the Middle Ages, and it's more of a Cinderella 16th, 17th century carriage. And this was when I was a new little author, and I got my first copy of the book, and I thought, well, this is really like a couple hundred years too late, you know. And I called my editor, and I said, oh, the book is wonderful, and because I'm really grateful that the publisher does all of this stuff. I said, you know, this one carriage is, you know, it's not quite in the right period. Thinking maybe she might want to change. And she was very nice and sweet and said, oh, I trust my editor. She's really good. She knows, you know, they know what they're talking about. And I tell them everything's wonderful and there's never been a problem. So I don't, there's just never been a problem.
Favorite books
that you have to sell so many thousands of books that you share with the writer, and then, of course, it's great if you can illustrate and write. This was with my publisher, who was the
people sign, have proposals and sign contracts on the basis of that kind of work. Like movies and, wow, they scary. The only time my college, my former college, not the college at which I attended, asked me to do anything was years after I had graduated. And they had a panel of children's writers who had graduated. And there were two tables. There was the more venerable table, the older table, the geezer table. And then it was younger. And the geezer table, I was sort of on the young side of the geezer table. And people on the left of me were bemoaning how publishing had changed. And people over here were sort of saying, oh, it's all so wonderful, the younger people. When I was first being published, submitted out of one of the transcripts, have I charged good luck? And for the first 8 or 9 books, I dealt with a publisher, and they told me what they would pay me, and I said, oh, good, right, because, I mean, it's nice, people are paying you for doing what you like to do. This is, and then my editor suggested that I needed an agent, because they had been brought up twice. So publishing, in fact, as I discovered at the user, young person's table, I think publishing, the business itself, has changed. Whereas I used to have to send a manuscript in to an editor, and the editor would say, yes, we'll take it. Now it has to be presented and sold to, I don't know, people want embeddings, which is a very different thing. This is a larger process, I think. And speaking personally, I'd like to go the old way. Right? No, we don't want this. Yes, we want this. I've been crying. But dealing with the publishing house, I live in Maine. You know, I don't love great foods. I'm not a marketing person. Thank God I have an agent. Yes. This is my agent. Maybe they're right, maybe the kids, I don't know, the letters don't indicate that the teachers are right. But that doesn't mean, you know, you're not even in the classroom, how do you know? Certainly, the entertainment experiential world these kids have available to them is is very different from what it was in the 80s. It's, you know, I've been to movies with when my son was young, we go to movies, and I'd sort of be, I'm watching the plot, I'm watching the character. Some of the costumes, like, you know, I'm taking in the basic storytelling stuff. And he's saying, did you hear the music? Do you know the volume of the music was there to emphasize it? I was like, whoa, this guy can watch split screen TV. I can't even, you know, I really have tried to with one. So I think probably all human beings know I'm exactly the same as a standard Neanderthal woman, right? In many important ways. And yes, I'm very different. And I think kids are, most importantly, the same. But in their sense of what entertainment is different. But I put in here, I mean, if I write a book, I'm not selling to the kids directly. I'll bench in my front door. I have to get through editors, publishers, reviewers, teachers, and librarians. Now, there's a sort of hedge of adults that says, this book, we like this book, we don't like this book. And this may be why often adults like books that kids don't like. And don't like books that kids do, other than that, as well as the usual, kids don't have them like this, don't have them like it, you know.
Yes.
phone call, you know, all different times of the day or night. I also like to write fiction, and if I'm writing fiction, I try and write every morning 5 days a week. I'm not an early morning person.
So what do you mean by morning?
Well, maybe 10 to 1 would be good. And I've got to walk the dog. I mean, you know, something like that. But I find I need to make it a habit because it's just really hard just to sit down every morning.
My morning's even a little earlier. In my head, I have this, I'm a morning writer 7 days a week. You know, it never works out. I mean, this morning I got up at 6:30. My grandson has been the night. So light gets in the way, but in my head, I've got the mornings blocked out for work. Which is the afternoons. Because I think writing is a part-time job. I think if you write 12 hours a day, the last 6 hours are not going to make very good sentences. And my imagination flags and syntax. Anyway, and I find I don't really have to do it. I just have to set. This is when my life is supposed to be okay. It's not that way today or the next day or the next day. But this is the way it is in some ideal universe that I have in my imagination. And then my ideal schedule ever in my life was I was teaching one class, and I told them I'm not going to do the full lunch. It's a private school, so that's okay. So I turned my family off to school in the morning, write for 8 hours, exercise a little bit, go to school, and teach my class, which was really, because you couldn't possibly try to continue thinking about your find a way about which one of the you're always trying to think about it. Then I come home and I hang out with my family and I make some lesson plans, correct some papers, and go to bed. Right? So I couldn't do more than the 4 hours I had slotted out. So it was both precious time and unvarying time. And that lasted for a couple of years. That was good.
I think the off time is really important.
Yeah.
Whatever else you're doing, it's kind of like your unconscious is going to work and things gel and ideas come out of the blue sometimes, but it's important. Not, I mean, there's no way I could write all the time.
No.
Okay. And that's, yeah.
I'm sometimes I feel like I can sort of say, oh yes, this is sixth grade. But it's nothing conscious. I think I can usually tell that's ringing false. Not always, but usually. And that's about as much conscious control as I have. And the best thing I can do to ease myself into it is to picture a little fifth grader standing up telling me that her rabbit died of pneumonia. The one uncrawlable, really uncrawlable student. You know, that kind of, I mean, it was. But I'm not. With it and then get your blue pencil out. You know, and have them get their blue pencil.
Yeah.
And then also the part of the kids are
no, I heard it's good. I'm raising questions. I'm not answering them. So I wasn't worried about answering the question. I was worried about pushing it out as far as I could, which means I don't have to deal with certain resonances that don't live there. And my job is just throw open windows.
I'm still thinking about it.
Yeah. No, I do myself. I do myself. Because I don't know the answers. I'm an English teacher. We never know answers. It's great. It was easier. I never think about it. I mean, okay, let's see, I've written a couple of early reader type books. Mm-hmm. And some of them are younger than this, like third, fourth, second, third, fourth grade, rather than what is called YA, which is, who knows. I think it's sort of sometimes, I don't even care. I mean, I was having correspondence from a wonderful woman in her 80s in Holland who had, during World War II, working with a nun, transporting Jewish children out of Holland. So this is where we say, I mean, she read my books and wrote me a letter. And I think she died, but, you know, we had these correspondence from that. I sort of figure, she's going to go, she wrote her book, she's in her 80s, you know. And I like to think that when I get it right, I don't have to worry about the target audience.
Well, I love that.
Sometimes. But if you gave them a chance to genuinely think about something, even if the way to look at it, it's, you know, they're at the edge of their good manners or staying at class. they prefer, people prefer to think, I think. They prefer to be given a chance to think. So that's what I would say, that they would be okay.
Independent bookstores are trying to get together. And there's a website now you can go to and just find your local independent bookstore to order books from. I think it's Indie Orb or something. Anyway, there's a website. I mean, I think they're trying to.
And they do a lot of shipping. Buy books at all, I think that's great.
Yeah.
Number of visits and things when a new book comes out. And, you know, then after that initial period, you know, up to maybe a year, then it kind of quiets down. But then when a new book comes out, it kind of, you know, starts up again for a while. So.
And do you like that credit, or is it just, I have to do it, or?
Oh, it's really fun, because writing is so quiet and solitary. And I used to teach nursery school, and I had my own kids, so it's really fun. It's really fun being with kids. Yeah, I mean, it's just a lot of energy. It's just really fun finding out what they're interested in, what they want to ask. So it's, no, it's a lot of fun. It's a trade-off because I wouldn't want to do it full-time because you need to stay at home and write, too. But you know, if there's a good balance, it's perfect. It's just really great going and doing that and then being at home and writing, too.
I know Alan Sokolowski.
They're giving back is what I said here. You know, like they might get a lot something out of it. But I walk out feeling more like myself than I do when I'm shopping.
Well, I really want to thank you all again for coming. Thanks to Cynthia and Ruth and Rebecca.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council, with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.